Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Malova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about real estate buyers in the UAE backing out of purchase agreements. Now, it has become a fairly recurring issue recently, just in the last few months. And the reasons buyers are pulling out fall into several categories. But primarily, some buyers, for example, are genuinely concerned about the regional situation in the recent months that stems from the conflict with Iran, and they're considering leaving the region altogether. Others are facing real financial pressure. The effects of the economy on their business mean that they no longer have the same ability or certainty that they had when they signed the agreements. Some are watching the market soften and want to renegotiate, and they would rather wait than carry on with their existing agreement. And others have simply lost confidence in the market. So what options do these buyers have under the UAE law? So, and what law governs? And what can sellers do in response? So let's unpack this topic today because it has been quite a hot one. So just to kind of understand the current geopolitical and economic backdrop, and that's the reason for the many kind of disputes and issues that we are facing today. Well, we are recording this in May of 2026. So the conflict in Iran is still fading, but it's still very recent and very real. So since early 2026, the UAE has been, and since the beginning of the conflict, the UAE has been directly affected by this regional conflict. And so we've seen interceptions that have been projectiles that have been fired towards the country, and there have been visible damage at iconic locations, and that has obviously resulted in affected negatively the tourism industry, and the foreign government travel advisors remain in place. So a lot of the European tourists that usually come in, millions, major segment of Dubai tourists, they have stopped coming, at least for the time being. So that's, one side of the equation that's obviously affecting the real estate market in real terms. The other one is the AI. I mean, we can deny it and we can question it, but it's happening. So layering kind of layered on top of this regional situation is the AI inroad onto white collar work, and the UAE there's a big segment and a big portion of the economy here is the white collar economy. So and jobs are being slashed across many customer service, administrative roles, paralegal support, banking back office, marketing, and sort of content production. So many employees are placed on sort of either paid leave, and others have been let go altogether. And so generally that means that income streams that looked secure 6 months ago are now less so secure. So obviously there's a trickle-down effect it's beyond the UAE as well. So many UAE real estate buyers are based abroad and earn their income abroad. And so the disposable income is tightening in many of those markets too. Some buyers want to keep money closer to their chests for obvious reasons at times like this. Some buyers just no longer have the income stream that they were counting on. And some buyers are opportunists, sensing sort of softening market and wanting a better deal. Some buyers have simply lost confidence. But whatever the reason may be, the practical effect is the same. Buyers are dragging their feet about closing, sellers are asking what they can do about it. So from the perspective of the UAE legal framework, there is, what kind of laws govern this sort of scenario? So there is a whole series of laws, and because what we're talking about today is real estate. And this is perhaps, this is important, kind of pause here for a second and kind of break down in terms of legislative frameworks that apply in real estate transactions. So first of all, real estate laws in the UAE are very much emirate specific. So every emirate has its own real estate laws. Now, for the purposes of making this discussion sort of more manageable today, I guess it's a podcast at least, we'll focus specifically on Dubai, because Dubai is perhaps has one of the most most developed real estate markets, and so most interest sort of these days kind of stems around Dubai real estate and Dubai investments. But let's say Ras Al Khaimah also recently experienced quite a bit of growth in the real estate market, is subject to different real estate laws. So every emirate has its own real estate laws, and then sort of layered on that, on top of that, are the federal laws that apply to, for example, contract interpretation and procedures and such. So you've got and then within within kind of the UAE, we have specific other sort of jurisdictions that are carved out from the federal system of laws. And that's in Dubai, it's the DIFC or Dubai International Financial Center that has its own laws and its own court system. And in Abu Dhabi, we've got the equivalents of ADJD, which is the Abu Dhabi Global Markets, also its own legal system, its own laws. Now, so therefore, we have the real estate laws that apply for each emirate has its own laws, and it has a federal law that applies depending on sort of the nature of the transaction, the interpretation of contracts and such. And then you have within all that, you have two other sort of legal systems that are subject to their own laws altogether. Now, just kind of to frame this, the discussion today is that the DIFC laws would apply to any properties, any real estate investments or real estate deals that are that relates to the DIFC, the DIFC properties in particular, or depending on the real estate investment that are subject to the DIFC laws. And same thing for ADGM. So it's if any properties related to ADGM or located there, they would be subject to the ADGM laws. But other than that, you know, basically we have for Dubai, we've got the Dubai, whole series of Dubai laws plus the federal laws, and now the Emirates have their own real estate laws plus the federal laws. So for example, from the perspective of the federal laws, you know, you have the civil code law, and that's the kind of the starting point for contract law. So, and that basically is the law that sets out contractual obligations and then corresponding breaches and remedies. So that's the civil code, and that applies to all emirates except the DIFC and ADJD, or ADGM rather. And so that's the civil law. And then we've got the civil procedures law. Again, that's the federal law that governs court procedure and enforcement of judgments, also applies. And then in Dubai itself, we have a whole series of Dubai laws. You know, there's the Dubai Law number 7 of 2006, which is concerning real estate, real property registration. And there's amended 2019. Then there is also a famous Dubai Law number 13 of 2008 regarding interim real property registration, and then in the Qud systems. And then there's the Dubai Law number 8 of 2007 on escrow accounts, and then you know, also bylaws number 25 of 2006 regarding real estate brokers registrations, and so on and so forth. So this is just the Dubai laws, a whole series of Dubai laws. And then other emirates obviously would have their own specific laws. So just to kind of give you an idea in terms of how many different laws can come into play. And it's important to know this, not because, you know, just, you know, here I'm sitting here as a lawyer talking about it, is because each one of these laws can give you one or the other side, either the buyer or the seller, an opportunity to either negotiate sort of this exit from this transaction, or at least help figure out who is, you know, who has an upper hand in the transaction and how to deal with it. So because each one of these laws can play an important role in the ultimate discussion. And so, let's talk about sort of start with the contract. So, you know, remedies, like let's say a buyer and seller, you know, here they are, they want to, you know, the seller is expecting for the buyer to kind of proceed with the transaction, and the buyer has cold feet and change of hearts and wants to back away. So what are the remedies, and we ultimately what from legal standpoint, what are we going to be looking at in deciding how to resolve this conflict? So let's start with the contract. So the contract is, you know, as I said, it's a starting point. It sets out what the parties agreed to and, you know, when and what happens if one side fails and sort of what the breaches are, or what the penalties are, and so on and so forth. But the contract does not govern at all times. And this is important because so many of the clients that we have, it's just they come with the contract, but the contract says this, but the contract says that. And I'll give you specific examples of, you know, some of the contracts that we deal with. And so the contract is a starting point. That's true, but it's not the only instrument that sort of does a play in these transactions. Ultimately, the law will always kind of override the contract. And override the contract, if, for example, especially if there's any provisions in the contract that are, you know, that sort of that are against the law. Or also the contracts, but in most cases still today, a lot of the contracts are drafted in the way that either there's a sort of conflicting provisions, or there's some uncertain terms or undefined terms. So that's when the law comes in, and the law kind of, you know, sort of layers on the interpretation of the contract. And usually one of the principles, just going to give you an example, so if the contract is not very well drafted, any kind of inconsistencies or ambiguities are usually interpreted as per the law. They're interpreted against the drafting party, right? Or get so in favor of the weaker party, i.e., in many cases, it will be, let's say, the seller usually kind of dictates the terms of the transaction, and the buyer sort of has less of an opportunity to negotiate. And so, therefore, in these kinds of cases, at least one of the legal arguments, and that stems from the law, is that if the contract is not well drafted, it's one-sided, so any kind of any sort of ambiguity will be, or inconsistency will be interpreted in favor of the weaker party. In this case, it would be, let's say, the party the buyer, because the contract is one-sided in favor of the seller. There's another also legal principle from that also stems from the civil law, and that is if the contract is so one-sided that it's just kind of lopsided as well, it can, or if it's a contract by adhesion, in other words, where the buyer had no option to negotiate. So, you know, so the contract itself as a legal instrument can also be, as per the law, not, you know, as can be basically challenged and invalidated, either because it's so one-sided and therefore grossly unfair, or if it's against public order, for example, you know, or if it's a contract of adhesion and, you know, and so the buyer is being placed, you know, kind of, is been kind of cornered in a way because they had no opportunity to negotiate. So each one of these is a sort of a legal principle that stems from the law that can ultimately either vary the contract or invalidate the contract or cancel the contract altogether, or at least basically sort of help interpret certain parts of the contract. So the summary of it is that whenever you have a transaction, a real estate transaction, you have a contract kind of between the parties, yes, and often that's the starting point, and the parties will go to the contract. Okay, so now I'm the buyer, you're the seller, so I want to back out. So we look at our contract and we decide what sort of the terms of our separation may be. Now, the contract is great if the parties agree. Right. So if the parties agree, so let's say in that key scenario where I'm the buyer and you're the seller, and we agreed that in the event I back out, like I have to pay whatever it is. And if I'm okay with that, well, then the contract is great. Right. But in most cases when that happens, and I'll explain to you also what the nuances of the UAE real estate transactions and Dubai transactions in particular, why in most cases it's there's always a dispute because the contract, it's not just about me as a buyer backing away. There's always a guarantee that's sort of tied to the contract that has a specific monetary interest involved, and therefore it's not so easy for the buyer, for example, for myself, to just kind of to back away from. So that's basically in terms of the legal authorities. This is what we've got. We've got the contract, right? We've got the law, the books of the law, though basically nobody almost publishes books anymore. And then you have, on top of that, then you have also what's called the jurisprudence or the court's interpretation of both, right? This is, let's say, for visual purposes, we'll make this the contract and this will be the law. So we can have a contract, we can have the law, and then there will be, but then somebody has to also interpret what does that contract mean and how does the law affect it or not. So then there's the court jurisprudence. That'll be our court. So this is a Well, these are all three sort of sources of authority in interpreting and ultimately deciding the terms and conditions of that specific transactions, and in particular in the context of today's podcast. So what are the terms upon which the parties can go separate ways, and specifically, what is the penalty, if any, for the buyer to be paying to walk away from the transaction, sort of breaching the agreement ultimately. And the courts, by the way, they have a pretty wide interpretation power in the UAE. And this is also kind of a subject of a different podcast, but usually in common law, this is expected, right? So in common law, it's the courts. The courts create law by interpreting law or applying the law. That's what's called common law. In civil law jurisdiction, which is the UAE, it's less about sort of to the interpretation of the courts. However, the UAE being the UAE, it's always very progressive and quite quite creative and industrious in the way that it picks up all the best practices from the world and applies it here. So similarly, although it's a civil law system, it does actually, the courts do exercise sort of expansive power of, it's called jurisprudence, or sort of set precedents. So they will, in a way, set precedents, and they will rely on these precedents for future cases. So this is an example of how, in addition to the contracts and the laws, we have a lot of court precedents that we rely on in sort of, first of all, for the purpose of today's podcast, this is an important source of information. So when I'm saying that, for example, the courts will challenge the validity of a certain contract or invalidate a certain contract, it's, it doesn't come from the contract, doesn't come from the law, it comes from the court's decision. So these are all very real decisions, and they are ultimately not just instructive, they are determining, and they're binding. So some examples, so in most notable terms for the purposes of today's discussion, is that courts, for example, liquidated damages. Courts will in most cases reduce liquidated damages, and that's, or liquidated damages are usually called the pre-agreed penalties. And so, let's say in this contract, the parties, the buyer and the seller, agreed that if the buyer backs away, the buyer has to pay, let's say, $1 million, right? That's kind of, that would be called the liquidated damages or sort of pre-agreed penalties. And so now the buyer, the seller may think, okay, well, if the buyer backs away, I'm going to take the seller to court and I will get my $1 million. It's the courts who ultimately have set this sort of, if you will, a source of law or precedence or jurisprudence, where it's almost in all cases they will review these liquidated damages and will determine whether they are proportionate to the overall sort of breach of the agreement, and specifically whether they are proportionate to the damage that the seller would have suffered. In other words, they will basically almost always reduce the liquidated damages to the actual damages that the seller would have suffered, which is very difficult to substantiate, and we can discuss this shortly. But so this is an example of how the courts, there's basically a source of law is the court's jurisprudence, and in particular in contracts, the real estate contracts, whatever damages might be included in here will most certainly will be reduced if it's ever presented to the courts. And that's because the courts, the jurisprudence is such that the courts want to see. So the way the courts look at a contract, okay, so you can't force the parties to do something they don't want to do. So if they want to go separate ways, that's fine. Okay, one side breaches the contract. Let's say me, I'm the buyer. I breach the contract. The court says, fine, okay, you have to pay a penalty. But what is that penalty? So the penalty, the way the courts look at it, is the penalty has to be proportionate to something. What is that? So it's proportionate to what the seller suffers as a result of my breach. So now the burden is on the seller to show what they suffer. So and unless they can substantiate that, and it's, this again we'll delve into it shortly, but the courts here don't usually look at like future damages or speculative damages to determine the sort of the alleged damages. So in other words, they have to be actual damage, they have to be substantiated. And most real estate contracts like this, it's almost impossible for the seller to show what damages they suffered as a result, like I said, of my breach. So that's basically an example of how a contract that may have very different provisions will not be enforced because the courts consider that to be sort of contrary to the law and the court's jurisprudence. So another nuance about the UAE jurisprudence there's no kind of injunctive relief, if you will. In other words, the court will never force the party to sell the property if the seller changes their mind, and equally so, they will not force the party to buy, right? So let's say I'm the buyer and you're the seller, and so I now back away. But in the contract, it says that, you know, I have no right to back away. I have to buy the property. Well, the courts in the UAE don't have that kind of power, for good reasons, I guess, for logical reasons, to force me to buy. So that's also important to understand, is that that will never be a remedy. So any of the sellers that may think that, well, we've got it in the contract, that in the event the buyer backs away, I will force them to buy anyway. They will have to buy. The court will order them. No, that's just, the courts don't have that power. They don't exercise that power in the UAE. So therefore, they'll never force the buyer to buy, and therefore we go back to, okay, so what are the damages? So they will only award damages for my breach. Okay, I am the one I'm the buyer, I'm the one that's wrong because I'm breaching the contract. So, but they will only look at what would be the appropriate compensation for me to pay to the seller for breaching the contract. So now all that applies to the kind of the UAE in general, and, you know, and other Emirates as well, and real estate transactions in Dubai and other Emirates, as per the UAE federal laws, except DFC and ADGM. Now, because ADGM and DFC are common law jurisdictions, in, you know, this is a bit sort of outside the today's topic, but common law jurisdictions, they usually sort of give more importance to the sanctity of contract. In other words, they enforce the meaning of the contract more so than the onshore UAE courts. So, for example, if there is in a DIFC contract or a DGM contract, there is a provision for liquidated damages, then in many cases, that provision will be enforced. So this is also kind of just the peculiarity or nuance of the UAE kind of legal practice. It's not uniform. So onshore cases, which basically means properties everywhere apart from these two geographic zones, which happen to be also legal, sort of independent legal jurisdictions, which is DIFC and ADGM. Apart from that, so there will the courts will look at at these contracts only as a data point, but they will not really. So it's not the objective to enforce every sort of meaning or every obligation in the contract. Whereas the DIFC and ADGM, they look more at, like, okay, well, these are sophisticated parties, they entered this contract, so we're going to try to enforce the party's intentions with the contract. So the chances of these kinds of, for example, liquidated damages or pre-agreed penalties to be enforced in the DIFC or DGM courts are greater, but as I said, those two courts are, their jurisdiction is limited. It's limited to either the properties within that is physically located within those jurisdictions, or if there's some kind of investment agreements that sort of that may be real estate investments, not so much specific property, but investments that are subject, by virtue of the agreement, are subject to the DFC or ADGM laws. In those cases, so that's those two courts only have jurisdiction over those two sort of narrow types of transactions. So let's talk about some kind of particularities about, of the UAE real estate transactions. And we'll focus in particular on Dubai because that's kind of where we have the flurry of activities these days. So we've got different types of legal instruments that parties have kind of ubiquitously come to know as MOU, SPA, Form F, and for them it's interesting that to this day people say MOU is just Memorandum of Understanding. So it's not an agreement. It's just a memorandum of understanding, or you know, or Form F, like, well, or SBA. I signed it, but it just basically said it's not binding. Well, it isn't so. Basically, it's more or less the same principle exists and applies in other jurisdictions, is that anything can be a contract, you know, and it just because it says it's not binding, it doesn't mean it isn't. So you look at this as substance of a form, right? It's look at the substance of the document. But MOU is a binding contract. SBA is a binding contract. The Form F is a binding contract. You know, something written on the paper napkin, the back of a paper napkin, can also be a binding contract. So it's important to understand that just because it's called an MOU, it's not to say that it's not a binding document. But these are usually documents that kind of come into play when we're talking about real estate transactions. So when we go through specific examples, in today's podcast, these are kind of, you know, if you want to imagine for your purposes, when we're talking about the contract, it could be any one of these instruments. It could be an MOU, it could be an SBA, it could be a Form F, it could be a private document that you sort of jotted down between you and the seller. So that's basically one kind of nuance, right? We don't really have, it's like one kind of agreement. So as perhaps is the practice in many other countries, where you just have one very voluminous, sort of complex legal document. Here we start with, there's an MOU, and then there is the Form F, and then there's the SBA, and there's an addendum, so the whole sort of series of legal documents, but each of which become kind of the sort of the legal framework for a specific real estate transaction. So that's kind of one nuance. And then often there's a lot of discrepancy and a lot of inconsistency between these different documents. And so that's why when I talked about earlier about the UAE laws that will look at, why they're so important to interpret the contracts, because often the contracts in the UAE are comprised of multiple documents. And then when you look at all the documents together, there's a lot of inconsistencies between them. So this is when the law comes in and it decides how to interpret these inconsistencies or ambiguities. And usually, as I mentioned earlier, it's they interpret it in favor of the weaker party or the non-drafting party specifically. So that's one sort of nuance of the UAE the transactions, so in Dubai in particular. The other one is that this notion of deposit checks. So it's truly a practice that exists in the UAE much more so than in the West. And that's, you know, anytime this MOU is signed, there's this expectation for the buyer to give a deposit check sort of as a guarantee for this transaction. Now, this check, by the way, this is not required by law, as, you know, unlike what some may think or maybe may try to convince you, there it's not by law. It's just a practice that developed. So whenever an agreement is signed, but an agreement, I mean, as well, it's an agreement is a bit of a, you know, an overstatement, but often sometimes people just sign these kind of, letter of intent or some kind of form of MOU or some kind of a document. And just on the back of that, but again, as I said, an overstatement to call them an actual agreement, but somehow a lot of the time, from our experience, in this case, the buyers, they have no qualms about issuing a check or a payment guarantee on the back of, you know, and along with this sort of signing of this initial reservation agreement, as well as another term. So this deposit check, it's not just, you know, in the West, for example, in the U.S., we've got this sort of called the earnest deposit, I think that's the term, and that's usually $5,000. Here, it's 10% of the purchase price. So it's quite significant, again, this is not mandated by law. It's all just practice. So as if you are a buyer and you are going through this sort of transaction, just keep this in mind. You are not required to give this deposit. You're not required to give this money by law if, you know, somebody tries to convince you otherwise. So this is just a practice that's developed, but it is all too common, which means that whenever parties sign, and by the way, when I say parties sign, it's not even parties. Usually it's just the buyer that signs. It's a one-sided document that's given by an agent. And so the buyer signs and issues this deposit. Well, now the deposit is usually kind of the biggest problem of it all. And this is where most of the cases you come to us is because of the deposit, because, you know, if I go back to the example of me, the buyer, and the seller, and we've got an agreement and I want to back away from the agreement, well, because it's just a piece of paper, I can, generally speaking, just walk away and leave it to the seller to file a case against me or to come after me. But the burden is going to be on the seller. And that would be very easy to do if it wasn't for this deposit. But now because this deposit is always issued, so there's it sort of binds the two parties together, and it makes it harder for me, here hypothetically me as a buyer, to just walk away. So in a way, that's perhaps why it's called a kind of guarantee. And in many cases, this deposit is drafted. So in the contracts, it's drafted this deposit basically in the event I, the buyer, decide to back away, or equally so the seller, if anyone else tries to back away, that deposit will be the compensation to one or the other party. That's how the contracts are drafted, though in practice, usually it's only the buyer that issues the check, not the seller. So to make it really sort of, you know, kind of fair, then both parties should be issuing the checks to each other. Because that's what the contract, usually the language of the underlying contracts referred to, is that in the event one of the other side party backs away, that deposit, the amount of that deposit, i.e. 10%, will become the penalty be paid to the other party. But in practical terms, it's usually the buyer that issues a check, and therefore only the buyer actually has interest, actual interest in this deal, not the seller, because the seller would never really issue the check. So that's kind of the other nuance. Now, and then to layer that on that is the check does not go to, these days, it used to be different, but the check does not go to the seller. The check stays in trust with the agent. So that's the other sort of nuance. One is you start with the different types of agreements. Then we've got this deposit check. And now what happens with the deposit check? The deposit check usually goes, it doesn't go, even though it's issued in the name of the seller, it doesn't go to the seller until the transaction basically closes. So it usually goes to the agent. Now, in many, things are evolving rapidly, and it's all on the back of the court interpretations, which the court hold is valid or not valid, enforceable, not enforceable. So the practices are changing and have changed visibly. But so if in the past the agents would perhaps a little too freely hand over that check, in this case, let's say to the seller, if I breached as a buyer, these days it's basically kind of common knowledge now that amongst agents that, legally speaking, agents in this case are acting as trustees. They are holding the check in trust. Therefore, they are not allowed to hand over the check to the seller if me, the buyer, for example, breaches. And so, and because, as I said, the practice has evolved, so in most of the documents these days, it's actually drafted to account for that interpretation by the courts. It has now become sort of well-established and common practice, is that the agent, if there's a dispute between me, the buyer, and the seller, so even if I'm the one that's completely wrong, I just decided to back away, the agent has no legal right to hand over that check to the seller unless there's a court order. So that's very important, because in the past there's a lot of cases, a lot of disputes against also the agents who should have acted as trustees and as guarantors of security of the check, would just freely give the check to the seller, and you know, obviously that was abuse of trust. So by now the practice has developed, so the agents kind of know that. So there's that other nuance about the deposit, which is 10%, and that's issued, and that's sort of in the hands. It's issued in the name of the seller, but it sits with the agent being the trustee. Another sort of layer to that is that the form of this deposit. So now deposit is issued usually as a check, as a personal check, which means that it's just, you know, it's a personal check. It has the name of the seller, but it's, you know, it's in the hands of the agent. And so, but that there, you know, that's just, it's just a check. It hasn't really been satisfied, or, you know, I didn't, as a buyer, I didn't have to take money out of my account to secure this check. I just basically issued the check from my personal bank, personal bank account, but it didn't require me to take money. So it's called a personal check. Sometimes, and we've seen this more often recently, is that these 10%, the 10% or the security is now so secured by what's called a manager's check, which is different from a personal check. So manager's check, it's basically a check that's issued, again, in the name of the seller, But it's as good as money. It's as good as cash. So for me to issue, manage this check in the name of a seller, I'd have to go to my bank. I have to take money out of my bank, let's say 1 million dirhams. I take that out. And that's on the back of that, the bank issues, manages checks in the check in the name of the seller. So it's very different from a personal check. So now, you know, that kind of adds another layer of complication to this form of security or the deposit for real estate transactions is if the money that, you know, the deposit that I gave to the agent is in fact a manager's check. And that's because if I want to back away as a buyer, okay, if I just a personal check, okay, well then I wait for the, it's the risk on me is limited because I'd have to wait. I would basically for the seller to bring a case against me to have to deal with this. Otherwise I could just back away and you know, leave it to the seller to decide to kind of carry the burden, if you will, in terms of what the seller wants to do, if anything, about trying to seek compensation for my breach. But if the deposit or this the security deposit was secured by virtue of a manager's check, that's, you know, now I have real interest at stake. And that is because for me to issue this manager's check, I had to take, let's say, 1 million dirhams from my bank account and issue the manager's check. So fine, if the check now sits with the agent, that's okay. But still, I am minus 1 million dirhams from my bank account or from my pocket. So this is the other kind of nuance of this the deposit check in real estate transactions. And each one of these is important in terms of figuring out what parties can and cannot do or should and should not do in the event they come to a point where they, in particular, I guess for the purpose of today's discussion, is that the buyer wants to back away. So again, if the buyer, if me, wants to back away and all I have is the check in the hands of the agent, a personal check, I can just say, well, you know what, I want to, I'm not interested in this transaction anymore. And then I wait for the seller to decide what they want to do. If, however, I have a manager's check at play, at hand, then that's now I have real interest. So now I actually have to be more proactive and more assertive in terms of how I exit this transaction, if at all. So that's kind of the other nuance of the real estate transactions, and this is which is important. But even in lately, what we've been seeing and is that this deposit check is issued not just by manager's check, but sometimes is actually even paid in cash. And it's paid in cash to, sometimes we've also seen examples, it's paid straight to the seller. And sometimes it's done because the buyer is trying to pay through crypto and it's becoming a lot more sort of difficult to pay through crypto these days. So long story short, as part of their deal is that they literally just hand the cash, you know, either by manager's check or by cash to the seller. So that's another level of exposure in this particular case, right? So in terms of me as a buyer, what remedies I have. So now, but if it's just a personal check, and I'll give you some examples of some of the disputes that involving each one of these, but if it's just a personal check, so it's also the seller has a bit of a false sense of security. The seller thinks, well, you know, I have a check as a deposit, so therefore I'm covered. Well, it ain't so because, as I mentioned earlier, as per the UAE jurisprudence, that check is in trust with the agent. And the agent has no right to give it to the seller, even if I'm wrong, because the agent is holding it in trust. And by law and in most these days, by most contracts, it clearly says that, but even if it didn't, by law it's required, the agent can only give that check upon court's order. So therefore it's, you know, the sellers who think, oh, that's fine. If, you know, I'm still secured, I'm covered. I'm not worried if the buyer is being, you know, sort of has cold feet and wants to back away from the transactions. No problem. I still have my 10%. It's not so simple. So this is also important to remember. So what kind of, let's talk about sort of what kind of disputes arise and what options exist in these circumstances. So when the buyer backs out and the seller wants to enforce, the dispute can take several forms, you know. And so what are the party's actual options? You know, option number one I always recommend is to settle. That should always be your primary option. And I hope that by the end of today's podcast, you will see the benefits of it and you'll see this, that it should be your primary option. In most cases, what we see is that the cases that start very differently ultimately still end up to into a settlement. So it should really be kind of the priority and the first option that you explore. So it's, you know, and obviously you need to settle on reasonable terms, and the parties, you know, in order to settle, you need to have reasonable terms, and the parties obviously need to have proper information to convince them to settle on terms that are reasonable for both. And this is, you know, in most cases, that's kind of where the settlement breaks down, because parties believe what they want to believe, right? So they usually, it's because they don't have the right information. And that's basically also why we're doing this podcast today, is just to give you the tools, to give you the right information, so to make better decisions, and so to help you actually come to a settlement. And in most cases, parties lack the right information, you know, let's say the seller or the buyer, and therefore they are less accepting or less welcoming of an actual sort of reasonable settlement discussions. So for example, sellers assume often that they can keep the deposit check automatically, and so they're covered. Well, that's false information, and therefore they're not interested in negotiating with buyers who wanted to back away, because they're operating on this sort of false information. So buyers as well, equally so, as I said earlier, buyers can also be acting on false information and think that they can just walk away without consequences, while they, for example, gave a check or a manager's check to the agent, and the agent is not going to give them the check back until the court issues a decision, for example, or if they gave the check, we've seen this, by the way, they've actually signed an agreement for the agent to give that money, that deposit, to the seller. So again, they're operating on the wrong information, thinking they can just walk away, not realizing the document they've signed basically authorized the agent to transfer their check to the seller. Therefore, now they have real money sort of at hand that they need to worry about. So when both sides are well informed, the settlement becomes much easier. So there's also obviously the practical point. If the buyer is generally backing away from the transaction because they no longer have money, so what's the issue kind of forcing the transaction? You know, what's the issue of what's the reason for the seller to play difficult? You know, if I as a buyer, I just, you know, let's say I lost a job and I won't be able to pay for this investment now. So what's the point for the seller to keep pressuring me and bullying me to go on with the transaction if I literally don't have money, right? And so, and as I said earlier, the court will never order me to buy this property. So sellers also need to know, in terms of what their negotiating positions are, what leverage they have or don't have in these transactions. And that's one example where they don't have this leverage, because the court will never force me to buy, especially, you know, and even the damages that they may order for me to pay to the seller will be very much proportionate to the seller's losses on the one hand, that have to be substantial. On the other hand, also my own financial abilities or capacities. And so if I don't have a job, chances are the court won't even order me to pay any kind of amounts to as compensation to the seller. Again, depends on the circumstances. The court proceedings cost money. So it's all of this reasons why parties should always start with a settlement, not with sort of going with their guns blazing, but rather with sort of a reasonable commercial approach with the objective to try to have some sort of a dialogue, come to the table and have a settlement. So that's, you know, that's basically option one, is to try to settle. And then option two is, like, as I mentioned earlier, you know, force the use of the deposit. So this is what many sellers want to do, and had examples of this, they think it's an option, but it isn't an option, because they want the agents, so the buyer backed away, clearly they're wrong, and the contract clearly says that if they back away, that check, that deposit check, becomes my remedy, so my compensation, so therefore you have to give it to me. And look, in some agreements they may even say so, that the agent will give that check to the seller. Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, as per the law, the Dubai laws, the govern agents, broker, real estate brokers, and that's bylaws number 85 of 2006, clearly put the burden on, or classify the agent as a trustee, and therefore they hold his deposit in trust, and they're not allowed to just hand over the deposit to the seller. So they can, you know, they can only be released with either by agreement, you know, of the parties, the seller and the buyer, or by court order. So the other, so option three is basically you can walk away. So, and we've discussed that. Sometimes it's just, it's depending on, we've talked about the different elements that comprise potential real estate transactions. So if me as a buyer, I only have, you know, and some, by the way, recently we've seen this as well. We've seen where the buyer doesn't give even the personal check. So if I didn't give the personal check, I didn't give the manager's check. So I really don't have anything specific or concrete now. It's sort of in on the line. So therefore, I can literally just walk away. And, you know, even if, and since I didn't even give my personal check, there's not even any sort of check that I have to worry about for the agent to return to me. So that's always an option. So one is settle, one is try to sort of force the payment of the deposit, which is actually really not kind of an option for sellers. And then, you know, the one option is always, you know, you just basically walk away. And then the final option, when everything else sort of falls through, is to go to court, right? So the options, in other words, whenever the parties are at odds with one another, in this particular case, me, the buyer, I'm going away, the best thing for me as a buyer, if I'm responsible, but really it depends, because it depends on, also my strategy depends on what I've got on the line. So if I don't even have a personal check in that I've handed over to the agent, and we've seen cases like this, as a buyer, I can literally just walk away. I can walk away and say, you know, listen, I've changed my mind for whatever reason. So now you, the seller, come after me if you want, and you can sue me. So that's, you know, that's, that option is always there. Now, the seller, though, before they decide to sue me, they need to hopefully listen to this podcast, because it's not so simple for them. Even if they were to file a case against me, you know, even if the contract is drafted in the way that seems very favorable to them, chances are the courts will not grant to the seller the damages or remedies that the seller may be expecting that may be mentioned in the contract. So, and then obviously if I have a personal check that's sitting with the agent, you know, that's something I should be aware of, because it's not good to have a check be floating somewhere there, you know, with a third party, because it's still a liability. Now, for me to issue that personal check, I didn't necessarily have to to take money from a bank account to issue it to the and give it to the in the hands of the agent, but it's still a liability that has my name that's attached to my bank account. So I wouldn't really feel comfortable having that check just floating around there. So as a buyer, then my strategy could be, okay, let's negotiate with the seller. I still want that check back. Maybe I'll pay some kind of some sort of an amount, some sort of a compensation that I can reasonably pay, just so I have the peace of mind and have that check back. So that's a different strategy. And the third strategy, obviously, if I have, instead of just a personal check, I have the manager's check, well, then that's real interest on the line. And that's my real cash that I had to take out of the bank account and give it to and convert it into manager's check and give it to the, in the hands of the agent. So in that case, me as a buyer, it's, you know, now the burden is on me to try to get that money back. So I can't just be take the lackadaisical approach of either walking away or waiting for the seller to pursue a court case. Now the burden is on me. I have to pursue the case to try to get that money back, because it's real money on the line that I've had to take out of my bank account and put towards this transaction. So that's basically, you know, where kind of the positions of the buyer and the seller depend on who will lead the way, depending on what sort of chips are laid on the table as part of this real estate transactions. So what is it, you know, so let's say we've gone through all this. We've done the settlement. We've exhausted the settlement that didn't work. You know, I've tried to offer something to the seller. The seller didn't accept it. And so what are the options? What's the last option? Well, the last option is always to go to court. Now, if we go to court, what does it really entail? So the court, as is the case everywhere else, it means cost, time, and uncertainty. So it's expensive, it's lengthy, and still the result ultimately is still uncertain, because much depends on these kind of underlying facts that I've described, or sort of data points that I described, the types of contracts that are signed, the terms in the contract, sort of the ambiguity, the conflict between the terms, the interpretation of the law, the parties' actions or inactions in the whole transaction. Therefore, the ultimate result will really depend. And by the way, we have a lot of the time, we have these questions from clients. So what are the chances? So will I win or will I not win? I mean, And so what do you expect? But it really, truly, truly depends on each one of these. Each one of these data points is a variable that can change the entire equation. So, but you what sort of, and then, you know, the court, let's kind of start with the most obvious. You know, when you go to file a court case, you have to pay court fees. And that's, you know, usually it's in most cases a real estate transaction, so it's 5% of the amount up to 40,000 dirhams. So it, off the bat, you have to pay 40,000 dirhams to the court in just court fees. And then you have translation fees, because anything you present to the onshore courts in the UAE has to be translated into Arabic. And it has to be translated, legally translated, not just by ChatGPT. So you have to pay somebody to stamp the legal translations of each one of these contracts we discussed, or the MOUs, unless they already had Arabic in them. But, you know, if also any kind of correspondences, any other undertakings, letters that might have been exchanged as part of this, well, they will all have to be legally translated. So it's additional cost and additional time. Then in most cases, in court cases, in such cases, the court will appoint what's called an expert who will go through all the documents, all the invoices, all the sort of the payments and bank statements and such, and will decide the kind of the mandate that the court will give it to decide. But in many cases, it's in most cases, okay, so how much money exchanged hands? And what does the contract say? And who did what, right? So there's also the expert fees you also have to pay. And then you have to pay lawyer fees, right? And that's it's all cumulative. So going to court is not inexpensive. Now the winning party in the local courts, the winning party will get its court fees back and get expert fees, but it will not get the lawyer's fees. So it is true that in most judgments, the judge will issue a statement that, you know, the losing party has to pay lawyer's fees, but usually lawyer's fees are limited to 1,000 dirhams, 500 dirhams, you know, 2,000 dirhams. So basically kind of almost, you know, no fees. So for the purposes, you know, while the language is there, and by the way, a lot of the time you'll see, that's another interesting comment, a lot of the time you'll see in the contracts, in the same MOUs, SPAs and, you know, addendums and whatever you call them, there'll be something that, okay, in the event of a dispute, so let's say the breaching party will have to pay legal fees of the non-breaching party. And a lot of the times the lawyers will also state the same. The lawyers will say, whenever they serve legal notice, they'll say, okay, we will come after you for the legal fees. But the UAE practice and jurisprudence is such that each party pays for its own legal fees. So that's not something that the parties need to kind of worry about. And that's an example of how something that's in the contract actually will not be enforced, because it's not in line with the overarching laws. There's one more nuance about the UAE jurisprudence, and in particular real estate transactions and parties, you know, intention to exit the transaction. And that is that whenever, let's say me, the buyer, I want to back away, ultimately what I want to do is I want to terminate the agreement, right? I want to exit the agreement. Now, as per the UAE jurisprudence, so if the parties don't agree, if me and the buyer and the seller do not agree on terminating the agreement, then it only falls in the authority, under the authority of the court or the judge, to terminate the agreement. So in other words, there cannot be any provisions in the contract that gives one or the other side the authority to terminate the agreement is not going to be enforceable. It's basically invalid under the UAE jurisprudence. So which means that only court ultimately have the ultimate decision to terminate the agreement and decide the compensation for the termination. And so this is, again, important when parties look at the agreement as sort of the starting point. It really is just the starting point. You know, I need to kind of layer it on or look at it from the filter of the UAE laws and jurisprudence to understand what that agreement will actually mean in practice if they were to fail to agree on amicable settlement and then therefore find themselves in court. furthermore, now when the court decides, okay, well, yes, let's say I will terminate this agreement because the buyer does not me does not want to proceed with the agreement. So I'm in breach. Okay, fine. So then the court will decide. Okay, well I order the agreement to be terminated and compensation for my breach, right? So but the court will always look at the actual damages. So I have to compensate the seller for my breach of the agreement. Now, what's that compensation? The way the courts look at it is the compensation has to not be what's in the agreement. It has to be actually proportionate to the damages that the seller suffered. So now the burden is on the seller to prove to the court what they suffered as a result of my breach. So speculative damages or future damages, they're not accepted in the UE jurisprudence. So this is important to remember. So in other words, the seller here will have to present actual receipts, kind of invoices and actual documentation showing actual loss. So and that's difficult, by the way, for sellers to find or substantiate actual loss, because what did they lose? How will they show that they lost something because of my breach? Now, let's say when I signed the agreement with the seller, I said I will buy this property for 2 million dirhams. And at that same time, they have correspondence from somebody else that says I will buy the same property for 2.5 million dirhams, right? For example. But let's say, but the seller, I mean, this almost never happens, but for speculative purposes, for illustration purposes, we'll use this example. But the seller really liked me and I really liked the property. Maybe there's some sort of sentimental relationship to the seller had this property and just wanted me to take over and be the new owner of that property. So he turns away that other offer for 2.5 million and sells it to me for 2 million or signs the contract to me for 2 million. So let's say in that specific example, the seller can show, okay, listen, I had two buyers. One offered me 2 million. The other one's 2.5 million. So I went with a 2 million lower because I, you know, I had some sentimental value. I, you know, she seemed more trustworthy. But this buyer offered me 2.5 million. So my actual damage here, I lost already 500,000. So that is an example that could potentially work in the court to show that the seller lost 500,000 dirhams. So that's an example, right? But it also, there's so many more nuances because that seller, that particular offer could also be speculative and it's, you know, until you had an actual agreement side by side, it's not so simple to basically show what the seller would actually have sold. Now, there's another sort of complication that comes into these UAE transactions or Dubai transactions, particularly, is that the agent always has an interest in the deal, right? So the agent also gets a percentage in, you know, so if the contract is terminated, so the parties, one of the other party breaches, the agent always gets, the way a lot of these transactions are drafted, the agent always gets a piece of the pie. So for example, there is the deposit that we talked about, let's say 1 million dirhams. So in most cases, the agent, the real estate agent, in the event I, the buyer, back away, the real estate agent gets 20%. In other words, the agent kind of becomes a vested party, an interested party in this dispute. So it's further complicating this transaction. And depending on who the agent represents and how sort of, you know, how the contracts are drafting. So that's another complication that comes in that should not be overlooked because the agent might, depending on the amount at stake, the agent may also want to file the case against you're the buyer, me, for example, for breaching, or the seller can file a case against the agent because let's say the agent claims an amount from me and let's say I'm paying this amount to the agent just to make him go away. So there's so many other kind of curveballs that can happen. So that's why sort of keeping the role of the agent in mind as part of this transaction is also important because they also can potentially become party to this litigation in particular. And throughout all of this, and this is the kind of the big element that sort of, you know, the elephant in the room, so to speak, is particular for the seller, is that what happens to the property in the meantime? So if we go to court and then here is the potential three of us, me, the buyer, and the seller, and the agent are all sort of involved in the court trying to argue what the proper compensation should be for this alleged breach of contract that I'm, you know, I've breached. So what's happening with the property? The property can potentially be kind of locked up and out of use, right? So there is a way, for example, for me as a buyer to block the property while the dispute is ongoing. So there's that option. So in other words, so the seller who filed a case against me hoping to get this compensation. In the meantime, cannot dispose of the property, right? Which means if there's another buyer that wants to come and buy the property, the property is out of commission. So that's also a big risk for the sellers to keep in mind as they're going through the process, and therefore, you know, another incentive potentially or hopefully for them to remember that it's always better to try to settle this dispute out of court because in the meantime, the longer the court proceedings are ongoing, the higher the chances or risks also that this property may not be in use. So let's say you may be able to rent it, but depending on what kind of a block me as a buyer can put on it. So the property is also kind of suspended, the status of the property. So that's another risk that it's important to keep in mind as part of this sort of the process of, grief or, coming to terms with this sort of broken transaction or a terminated transaction. So now to add kind of, as the saying goes, to add insult to injury. So there's multiple levels of the court proceedings. In the UAE, you've got the Court of First Instance, Court of Appeals, and the Court of Cassation. So even if, for example, let's say the seller wins on the Court of First Instance for some reason, I can still appeal. And I can appeal to the Court of Appeal. And then after that, I can still appeal to the Court of Cassation. So in other words, the legal proceedings can last much longer. And therefore, also for the purposes of both parties, but in particular, let's say if the seller is the one filing the case, they need to keep in mind that they will continue to pay for the court fees, although the court fees get cheaper as you go up the ladder, but still for lawyers' fees. And then, and that also kind of keeps the property potentially in sort of a suspended state, and the longer the proceedings go on. So that's another variable into this whole equation. So which, cumulative speaking, if you look at all of this, the contract, the check, the role of different parties, the agent, the seller, the buyer, the circumstance, underlying circumstances, and sort of the different, the lawyers, the styles of the lawyers in sort of litigating this dispute. So the costs that involve in filing a court case. So all of that, should be looked at cumulatively by both parties, but in particular the party that wants to file a court case to fight. Analyze whether it's actually really worth it for you to file a court case, or better figure out a way to settle this out of court and sitting at the table and figuring out some other solution. Now, just kind of briefly, as I said, this all applies to mainland courts. In ADGM and in DFC, the things are different. So the contract there will be kind of interpreted more as per the party's intention. So if the contract does involve properties or the properties relate to one of these geographic zones, then there may be a different outcome, again, depending on how the contracts are drafted. Now, in other words, the moral of the story is that my advice is to always try to have a settlement. Now, what are some of the settlement ideas? So once both sides understand how the UAE legal system actually works, the settlement becomes much more palatable. And so here's some of the ideas of what kind of practices settlements we've seen in practice that seem to work. One is a goodwill payment. So the buyer pays the seller an amount that they can stomach, for example, not the full amount of the deposit, but something reasonable as a recognition that the seller has been inconvenienced. And then at that point, both sides walk away and the contract is, interpretation of the contract becomes of, no relevance, right? So that's basically one option, so a goodwill payment. The other one is to explain, as a buyer, to the seller, I explain just the human position. I sit down with the seller and say, listen, I lost my job. I do not have money to go with this transaction. So I'm just being honest with you. I cannot proceed. and the buyer sort of, and the, you know, and the basically, and the seller, if the seller is also reasonable, you know, just decides, you know what, it's, what am I going to do? Like, I'm not going to go to court because it's going to cost me money and the results are still uncertain. And ultimately, you know, I can see this person is really, her circumstances have changed. And so I'm not going to force her to do something that she cannot financially do. So that's, you know, that's also a very reasonable, sort of resolution to one's dispute. And that's just the human side of the story. The other option is basically to read the contract and so to challenge the contract on legal grounds. So sometimes the contract itself, as I mentioned before, you know, gives the buyer leverage, right? So some clauses may be unfair, they could be unreasonable, or they can be unenforceable under the UAE law. And then the penalty clauses requiring, for example, the buyer to pay 50% of the purchase price on the breach are still unlikely to be upheld in full anyway. So, and then equally, like, forced purchase clauses are not enforceable because UAE courts will not order that kind of specific performance. So you can basically look at and then, you know, challenge the contract on the basis of legal grounds. You know? And so therefore, you sit down, me as a buyer, I sit down with the seller, listen, yes, I understand, you know, I have to now back away. But look, this contract is fraught with all sorts of sort of legal issues, and therefore it will never be enforced. So I'm sorry, I'm just backing away and I'm not paying you anything because this overall transaction or this contract is unenforceable anyway. The other grounds for me, again, we're talking me as a seller, is to on which to challenge the transaction and, you know, and even to claim potentially the back my deposit. Let's say if I pay the deposit in cash, right, or the manager's check, is to challenge the basis the party's actions or inaction. So, for example, in other words, breach by one of the parties. Let's say there's an agent and there's a seller. So somebody, so the seller might have breached an obligation under the law, which gives me as a buyer an excuse to claim money back for my deposit, for example, or yes, for, at least for the deposit. I mean, as a buyer, I would only really want to bring a case against the seller, or at least threaten the seller, if I think that, you know, if I have real issue, real sort of money on the table or on the line, such as if I pay a deposit by way of actual cash, right? So here, for example, one common example is the failure to register the disposition of interest within the required time. That's mandated by the Dubai law, which is law number 7, 2006, concerning real property registration. That's Article 6 and 9. And so under that law, for example, the DLD is the sole authority to register real property rights. And the transactions that create, transfer, amend, or extinguish real property rights are not deemed valid unless they're recorded in the property register. And for, you know, off-plan units, for example, registration must be done in the interim registration within, you know, 30 days of the sale. So let's say that's not done, if the property is not, the disposition of the property is not registered on time, that gives me, the buyer, a legal ground to challenge or to accuse the seller of breaching the law. And if they breach the law, then all of a sudden now I have a legal right to claim back my deposit because the seller is the one who breached, for example. Equally so, you can also allege a breach of law by the agent, right? And that's the agent, for example, who has breached my trust and gave my check to the seller. So I can also file a case as a buyer against, or at least threaten the agent for having breached my trust. And that's, you know, that's my way of kind of trying to push to leverage this transaction. And in this case, you know, for put the agent, sort of the burden on the agent to either figure out and give me the deposit back or compensate me because they're the ones who have breached the law. So these are kind of the legal arguments that I have as a buyer to enforce or sort of, you know, shift negotiating positions. You know, and sometimes, like, some buyers would just may want to kind of just wait it out, knowing kind of how the system works. You know, I've just sort of described the different variables that could be at play. I could basically just wait and see what one or the other party, either the agent or the seller, will do. And if I don't have actual real money on the table, and there is, you know, I may just kind of wait it out and ignore this whole transaction altogether. So let me just give you kind of a few recent examples that we have you've seen in our practice of how these things can sort of be resolved. So one, and that's an example of like a goodwill payment in practice, or we're representing a client who's a seller. If seller signed the agreement, you know, had a deposit from the buyer that we discussed about, so for all intents and purposes, he felt the transaction was secured and he was moving forward. Then the war in Iran broke out. The buyer wanted to back out. So our client initially wanted to keep the deposit check as a penalty, knowing the deposit was with the agent. Says, you know, I'm fine. It's okay. The agent wants to, if the buyer wants to back out, no, not a problem. You know, I've got that deposit check, so it's going to cover me. So he was convinced that he can cover, sort of, he can get something out of this, my breach, or the, not my breach in this case, it was the breach of the buyer, because he had this check. Well, you know, he came to us, he said, like, okay, this is, I want this check as my penalty. And so this is where we had to advise the client, well, you know, that check is just, you can't, you don't have the right, the automatic right to that check. That check actually is in trust with the agent, and the agent will not be able to give it back to you unless we have a court order. Now, a court, going to court is, you know, for all the reasons I've discussed today, is not worth it. So is there another option for you to deal with this buyer? And it happened, so we have a very reasonable client, the seller, and the buyer is also very reasonable. And the buyer just approached our client, the seller, from a very human standpoint, said, listen, I've lost my job. I cannot proceed with this transaction. But I'm offering you, let's say, something like, I think, 25 or 50,000 dirhams as a just sort of a goodwill payment just to compensate you for the headache, but I'm sorry, I won't be able to pursue this transaction. And so in that case, that's exactly what our client accepted, said, fine, listen, from a human perspective, he understood this, you know, the buyer's position changed and he's not in a position now to proceed with the transaction. On top of that, the buyer acted very, you know, professionally and courteously and very reasonable and very apologetic. So that also appealed to our clients. I'm not going to drag this person through the courts for something that, you know, they're obviously in the position to do. But on top of that, kind of in parallel, we also educated the client that even if he wanted to go to court, the chances of him being able to recover something, you know, are very, very suspect, but the costs are very real in having to go through the proceedings. The other case we had recently is that a client wanted to buy also, we're representing a buyer, in that case it's a seller, a buyer wanted to buy a very high-end, high-value villa, and the contract was so, it's one of the few contracts I've seen recently, was so extremely onerous terms that were placed on the buyer, so I was just kind of scratching my head trying to figure out how the buyer's agent would allow him to sign this kind of a contract because it was not in the favor of the buyer. And one of the most kind of notable things in this contract is that the buyer, our client, was required to pay 50% of the purchase price as a penalty if the buyer wanted to back out of the contract. So in other words, you know, there's a specific provisions there. So if the buyer decides to back away from the contract, then he has to pay 50% of the purchase price as a penalty. Well, in that case, the 50% was 20 million dirhams. It's a lot of money. So this is an example. And so obviously the buyer in our case, this client, I mean, already paid about 1 million dirhams as a deposit to the seller. And so, but it was, you know, at this point when he came to us, he was worried less about the 1 million. He was more worried about whether he would be forced to pay the remaining 19 million as a penalty as per the contract. So this is where we explained to him that this contract would ultimately not be enforceable. It would be considered highly unreasonable and unconscionable and unjust enrichment and ultimately will not be enforced by the court. So at least he was not on the hook for the additional 19 million. So this is an example of how a contract that was, you know, rather detailed and in terms of the penalties that were the buyer was basically accepting to pay in the event of a breach, that it's, you know, the contract would not, it's the starting point, but ultimately would not be the end point. The courts would not enforce that contract. Then separately, there was another sort of question about the deposit, which in this case, the buyer actually paid the deposit in cash. And so once we explained to him that he's not going to be on the hook for the additional 19 million dirhams, yeah, so, but we also said, listen, he kind of had already made peace that the 1 million dirham in deposit is just, you know, that's lost. But then, you know, looking at the sort of the UAE laws about compensation for, you know, for a breach of contract and such, we said, listen, there's even a good argument if you wanted to, for you to To challenge this payment or to try to claw back at least part of this payment on the grounds that, let's say, parties breach certain laws. And in that case, the contract was not registered with the land department, so that's, you know, a breach of the law. So there were other legal arguments that potentially the buyer in this case could challenge basically the payment that they've already paid as a deposit and try to claw it back. So it much depends on how much money is at stake. In this case, 1 million dirhams is a lot of money that was paid a deposit. So there is, you know, there may potentially be an incentive for the buyer to still file a case and try to claw some of it back. But, you know, given the sort of the amount of this transaction and the value of this transaction was so substantial that, you know, sometimes you'd be surprised, but sometimes these, for parties or the buyers, it's leaving 1 million dirhams on the table for sort of changing their mind to go ahead with this transaction is not a big deal. So, you know, so that also is an option. You know, if it's a money, 1 million dirhams you can leave on the table and not worry about it, okay, well, that's also, I guess, an option. But so that's a specific example we just recently dealt. Another example we had is a buyer who also wanted to back away because of the regional conflict. But in this case, he was applying for a mortgage, you know, for this specific property. And in the contract, it was clearly, this is where the contract actually helps. And this is, it was clearly said that the contract was subject to the buyer obtaining the mortgage. And in the event he is not able to obtain the mortgage, so basically that the buyer could walk away without any penalty. So in this particular case, the contract was in the buyer's favor because it was drafted in a way, it was specific, and it was not against the law. Right. So this is an example. So in this case, basically, the buyer who was now very uncertain about because of the regional sort of uncertainty was equally uncertain about his job prospects and whether he would be able to service this mortgage. So basically, you know, the advice was, well, you know, if you're going to be, you cannot in good faith proceed with this mortgage knowing that your job is on the line because you're not going to be able to service this loan. So you have to basically notify the bank, and that's, you know, and that this whole mortgage and the whole transaction was specifically based on the bank's issuance of a letter for the mortgage has been approved. But the bank, once it found out that the client was losing his job and he wasn't going to be in position to secure the loan, because basically becomes a risk management. So the bank did not issue the mortgage letter, and therefore, in this case, the buyer was able to use that specific example of, you know, the specific term in the agreement, and the and basic lack of the mortgage letter to back away from the transaction without any penalty. So, and then, you know, so that's another example. And the last example, this, by the way, also happens, and it's something to keep in mind, is just renegotiating the price. Because of the circumstances that are happening, some people, they just say, listen, I still want to buy, but I know the market is softening, so I don't want to buy for this price. Now, the seller may equally be still interested in selling and understanding how the market has changed and kind of also calculating the risks and thinking, okay, if I've got a buyer now who I know is interested in this property, okay, let's say the property is 2 million and now the buyer says, I'll buy it for 1.5 million because I think that's kind of the... So the seller may still be interested in selling it for a lesser amount. So that is also one option. That's also basically an alternative to this dispute. And that should also be regarded as such. So therefore, you know, again, it's a commercial transaction. So if it still makes sense for the seller to sell at like a lesser price, it's in their interest not to stick to the contract and not to threaten each other with lawsuits and such, but rather look at it more from a commercial standpoint and decide, okay, well, still as a seller, it still makes sense for me to sell this. Now, I got the buyer who will buy it for this price. Fine. It's not the same price that we agreed on originally, but still makes sense for me and it still makes sense for them. So let's renegotiate the price. So that's also an option. Okay, so in conclusion, sort of let me kind of summarize. As we've discussed, the UAE real estate transaction sit at kind of intersection of several legal framework, right? There's the federal law, there's the Dubai-specific and Emirates-specific real estate laws, there's specific laws that apply to brokers that also come into play in these transactions. And then there is, as we've discussed, lots of court precedents and court procedures. And then there's, you know, the specific laws of specific jurisdictions and free zones, such as GFC and the ADGM. So it's quite a complex legal framework that we need to keep in mind. And then there's specific sort of nuances of, that are very particular to the UAE. So, for example, just kind of in summary, only the courts can cancel a contract if the parties do not agree. So this is important to remember. Also, only the courts can decide on the appropriate remedy, and that may not be what the contract says. And in most cases, it isn't. And also, the UAE courts regularly reduce the pre-agreed penalties to actual substantiated damages. And then also another important factor is the UAE courts do not order specific performance. So they will not order for the buyer to proceed with the transaction and buy. And then finally, so the deposit checks held by agents must remain in trust with both until both parties agree, or until there is a court order that dictates them or mandates otherwise. So the moral of the story to all this, this is, real estate investment is just a business transaction. So, and things need to make commercial sense. And if you cannot force someone to pay for something they do not have money for, and the courts also will not order them to do so. And keep in mind that as you work to keep all these sort of factors in mind as you work through the process and your negotiation. So it's almost always better to ultimately sit down, negotiate, and try to achieve an amicable settlement out of court. Because going to court, especially on false premises and false expectations, is the most expensive way to learn how the system actually works. And that's why we've got this podcast. So hopefully you don't have to do that. That's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website. That's lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can watch our video podcast on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.